Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We think there are more than 308 million people in the United States, and to be sure, there is the census. Sure as shooting, every 10 years, and 2010 is one of those magic years. But every census has its issues, some minor, some major. What's the deal this year? We've invited Professor Margo Anderson to help us out. Margo is a professor of American history and urban studies at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. She has published several books on the census, including Who Counts? The Politics of Census Taking in Contemporary America with Stephen Feinberg. She researches statistical confidentiality and statistics and human rights. And wherever you see an authoritative quote on the topic of census, it often is hers. Welcome to the show, Margo.
Thank you.
So I said, as I said earlier, every census has its issues. Are they usually the same thing decade after decade, or do they change?
Well, the underlying issues are always the same, and that is that the census is designed, because of the U.S. Constitution, to reapportion seats in the House of Representatives and in the Electoral College on the basis of a new population count. So every 10 years, political power in the country shifts because of the census, and that's a constant.
Now, there was an issue, was it in 1990 or was it in the 2000 census, where there was a question about how the data was used to make that decision?
No, it was used as it had been for the previous 200 years, namely that the census was used to reapportion Congress, the seats in the House, when the results came out in December of 2000, and then a few months later, data comes out for redistricting, which is a much more detailed file of data, which is then given to the states and local governments, and then used to redistrict every single legislative district around the country.
Why did it become a controversy at the time, then? Am I wrong about that? It was a partisan controversy?
Well, from the ninth, the Census Bureau has, over the the centuries now, slowly improved the count and has improved the technology of it. And about 50 years ago, when probability sampling was invented, in other words, a method that that we now use for public opinion surveys all the time, they were able for the first time to sort of answer a question that had been nagging at them for about 150 years, but they didn't have the technology and the science to do it. Namely, is this accurate? How accurate? Are we missing people? Are we counting people twice? And so forth. And they actually, it was a kind of natural experiment in 1940 when the Census Bureau, the census was taken that year just at the same point that the imminent World War II draft registration took place. And the Census Bureau was asked by the Selective Service System to give estimates of how many young men there would be so that they could print, draft registration cards. Okay. It turned out, and so the census was taken in April, and the draft registration was in October, and it turned out that millions more men registered for the draft than the Census Bureau thought existed in the country. In other words, which was the discovery of the undercount. Mm-hmm. Like, whoops, we're missing people. Young men are a hard group to count. They also discovered that because the U.S. military was segregated at the time, there was a question on the racial background of the registrant in both data systems. And so they were then able to see that they were actually undercounting black men at a higher rate than white men. In other words, many more black men registered for the draft than the Census Bureau thought existed in the country. That discovery led to, over the next 30, 40 years, a research process of trying to figure out, one, how to measure it much more systematically. And then after the 1970s, after the one man, one vote decisions and the civil rights movement, a civil rights claim that, in fact, the Census Bureau had to do better on the basis of, because of the, they had to remedy the problems of counting. Those issues came to, in some ways, ahead in the 80s and 90s over both technical issues of counting and over the politics of doing it. And that's when it, about 30 years into this scientific debate, it became a partisan issue when Democrats pushed for the new methods and Republicans were suspicious that the new methods would allow a partisan Commerce Department to sort of pad the numbers. That led to a series of lawsuits over the 80s and 90s and a Supreme Court decision in basically 1999 that said, look, just use the regular numbers for 2000. And then they kicked the can down the road to say, well, in 2001, you can decide whether to adjust them for redistricting. And then by that time, the administration had changed, and both the Census Bureau and the Commerce Department said, no, we're not going to. So that's the history of that discussion. It isn't a live issue, as you've noticed, this mm-hmm. decade, because the planning to build in the methods that would be necessary to do an adjustment would have had to been put in place 3, 5, 6, 7 years ago, and they weren't.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Margot Anderson. She's a professor of history and urban studies at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. She's also a historian on the census. We're talking about the census right now. It is 2010 and time to send in your form. But, Margot, a lot of folks don't send in their forms for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
Why are young men a hard group to count?
Well, any person that has a kind of difficult residence status or an ambiguous residence status is hard to count, and this has always been the case. Americans are a very mobile population. The rule of thumb is that 1 in 5 of us moves every year, or 20% of us move every year. The method of the census of the methodology since 1970, by the way, of the census is to send a census form to every identifiable residential address in the country, not to a person but to the address. Okay, and then the one person in the household has to then pick up that form and sort of fill it out and mail it back in. Okay, there's two issues. If nobody in the household picks up the form, fills it out, and sends it back in, they send out a census taker to look. Why didn't it come back? And that could be anything from it was misaddressed and it never got to the person versus I thought it was junk mail and I threw it away, to I was going to do it tomorrow but I never got to it, I don't like filling out forms, any number of things. It also is the case that the person who fills out the form might have questions about whether somebody really lives there, right, in the sense of...
Oh, they don't understand how to answer the questions.
Well, it's not even that. Not even that they don't understand. It's that the status of someone in the household is ambiguous. Should you list someone who I actually have a colleague who for whom this is an issue right now. An adult child has moved home, but is on the market. Is about to move out. Well, mm-hmm. Does that person get listed or not?
What's the answer?
Well, the technical answer that the Census Bureau would say is if that person is there on April 1st, yes.
Okay.
Right? There's also, though, another problem. What if that person is living there April 1st but also has another residence? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore another address. So therefore another census form went someplace else, perhaps back to the roommate in the old apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that roommate says, well, so-and-so's still paying rent, so I guess I'll list him or her. Okay. Now, so mm-hmm. you end up with double problems. You end up with both the ambiguities of missing people and the ambiguities of counting people twice. There are issues of people who have families with children in joint custody, households with two homes. The sunbird snowbird issue.
Mm-hmm.
So any number of ambiguous situations, and it turns out that young people, particularly young men, and that's the reason that the undercount was discovered for young men, are among the more footloose members of our population.
Now, there's others that by choice or not are homeless. Is that a bigger problem now, or has it been an ongoing,
steady stream
of a problem?
I'm afraid Americans have always had people who've been living on the lam or living mm-hmm. in railroad cars or on the road or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in the pre-1970 period, in other words, before 1970, before we used the mail to do the census, the enumerator was actually simply given a piece of geographic territory and said, go walk it until you find everybody. So it was a different methodology. So presumably, and there were instructions, like if you find somebody, you know, living in an alley, you know, living on a subway grate and so forth, this is what you do. Right. There have always been special procedures also for what they call for transient nights, and they work, the Census Bureau works with advocates in the homeless community to identify places that people, you know, camp out under bridges and so forth. So that, you know, there are procedures to count that stuff.
A controversial issue is undocumented residents.
Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to be one of the biggest problems. Mm-hmm. This year, because of the controversy on a couple different levels, the controversy mm-hmm. over immigration mm-hmm. and the status of mm-hmm. their illegal status, but also some people are being advised not to as a mm-hmm. protest because mm-hmm. of the lack of immigration reform.
That's right.
Do you expect that to show up in the numbers necessarily?
Well, if you notice, if you've looked at the census form, you'll notice that there's no question on it that says, are
no.
you here legitimately?
No.
Right. So there's the only way we know that, you know, in general, that there are undocumented immigrants in the country is by what is called a residual method, which is that we can identify, you know, through our immigration and emigration statistics, who's here legally, and then we see we have essentially more people than more foreign-born population in the country than are accounted for. So those people become our estimates of the undocumented. We can't identify. We don't have any data system that sort of sits there and says, here's the undocumented, you know, person.
Right. They ask you for your name and your address, but not your Social Security number or anything
right,
like that.
Right, exactly. So what happens, again, this issue has come up, repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a sort of a policy issue really only since 1980. Because until, you know, for the first 120 or so years of the Republic, there was no such concept of being an undocumented immigrant. You just walked in the country,
mm-hmm.
right? The from the 20s through the 1960s, we had very, very tight immigration controls for Europeans and people from Asia and other parts of the world, but none really for North Americans, Mexicans and Canadians and so forth. In 65, we changed that, and so the tradition of the open border on both, you know, the northern and the southern border of the United States suddenly became a way that, you know, so people who had been going back and forth for years suddenly became undocumented because they were built into the immigration system and the green card system. So every census since 1980, there has been a discussion over this. There have been various lawsuits over it. None of them have made headway in the courts essentially trying to ask to remove, quote, the undocumented from the apportionment or the redistricting totals. And so far that has not happened.
Okay, we're going to have to take a short break. My
mm-hmm.
guest is Margot Anderson. She's a history and urban studies professor at the University of Wisconsin. We're talking to her today because she's also an historian of the U.S. Census. If you would like to join the conversation or have a question for Margot, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to get the latest information from the station the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Just go to wosu.org/email, and you can sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And remember, on your way home, get perspective on all the day's news on All Things Considered and the business news on Marketplace. Weekdays starting at 4 on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20. Sunshine today and a high near 70. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Professor Margo Anderson from the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. She is a census historian, and that's what we're talking about right now because it is census time in the U.S. Margo, I want to get back to that idea of how to define a home, how do you know where somebody lives is what qualifies as a census definition of home. And also, because of the foreclosure crisis, so many people have been forced out of their homes and are doubling up. And is that something that you think will show up in any form on the census?
I think that's actually going to be one of the big issues. What the Census Bureau does, is sort of administratively, is a couple of years before the count, and in conjunction with the Postal Service and other companies that do address rostering, they create a very large mailing list, over 100 million addresses, and then they, barcode and send a form to those addresses. I know from my own city, and I've seen this around the country, that the housing and foreclosure crisis has created lots of unsold but probably addressed units in which the Census Bureau probably has on the address list. So those forms are going to go to the addresses and presumably won't come back because there's nobody living in them. And the Postal Service may, in fact, report that there's no one living there. But there will have to be then a check of every single address that doesn't return the form. And so the Census Bureau has, on the website now, you can go up and look at what is called the mail participation rate to see in flow time the forms are coming in. The national rate today is 50%. They point out that they will, they have another measure called the response rate, which means actually the ones that people actually respond. But then the participation rate is actually much higher because about 5 or 6% of the people who don't, the addresses that they don't get responses for are vacant. So we're going to see if that number goes up this year.
You know, speaking of the counters,
yeah.
How can there possibly be enough counters out there to do this job?
Oh.
How can they hire that many people?
Oh, the Census Bureau is really good at this.
Okay.
first of all, you realize they've been doing it for, a couple hundred years. And it's really, if you think about the 19th century and you think about because some of the work that I've done about the needing military escorts to go out into frontier and rural areas the logistics of communication in the backwaters of frontier America. So, things are much quicker and much easier to deal with today than they were, 100 to 150 years ago. So there has been and is a large recruitment effort going on. If you go to, the census website, you can, click your way through to your local job center and apply to become an enumerator or take on a job. The Bureau has a system of creating, I don't know if they're using them this decade, but of cardboard furniture, so that they set up these temporary offices which exist for just a couple of months and very much almost in military with military like efficiencies come into a local area, set up, do their job, and then break it all down and mothball it for another 10 years.
It seems like there's a lot more attention being paid to pitch the campaign to Americans, and to people who live here, not just Americans, whoever lives here. Are they spending more money on this? Is there more of a concerted effort to
the push to go to a substantial advertising campaign actually was in some ways the outcome of the undercount controversy in the 80s and 90s. In other words, once the courts decided that they weren't going to use the statistical methodology, then the only other other method of making sure that people fill out the form is a huge and increased public awareness campaign, which is what they've done. Congress appropriated, was quite willing in the 90s to appropriate that. In fact, they appropriated more money than the Bureau actually needed. The Bureau paid back into the Treasury unspent funding in 2000. And, of course, the big change this decade is all the new media, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have gone to great extents to begin to explore, you know, Facebook, Twitter, all the new, they've got a bus. They've got, outreach campaigns with all kinds of local government and agencies. So that's been the major push for the decade. Now, whether that's going to survive the 20 teens, I don't know. We may, because it's expensive, and there's now some talk about going to an even more high-tech, electronic form of census taking.
Well, it's apparently not working in Ohio. I think we're dead last in the country in terms of returning the census information.
No, you're not.
No, we're not? Okay.
No. You're a few. In fact, I looked that up this morning.
Okay.
The Ohio is, I think it's 50%. It's a little under, but not much. Right?
Oh, okay. Well, I was listening to something this morning on the air. That's why I brought that up. I apologize.
No.
Okay. Ohio is doing just fine, folks. Let's take a call now, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nancy, you have two questions. You want to know how to get a form. I imagine you can just go to the Census Bureau for that, can't you?
Yes.
Okay. Nancy, you're on the air.
I'm going to ask how the census is handled, or should be handled, in nursing homes. And what if a resident totally messed up her form and lost the return envelope and so on? How can she get another? Or should the nursing home be supervising all of this?
Yeah, a nursing home is part of what they call the group quarters population. Dormitories, college dormitories, nursing homes, hospitals, any kind of institutional residential site actually has a separate set of procedures. And the Census Bureau rosters those institutions, and then it is usually up to the institution to do the actual census count. So for example, a college dorm or a hospital or a nursing home should have to report who's living, who's there on April 1st.
So the resident, the one I'm thinking of, doesn't need to do a separate.
Should not. I mean, if you're interested, I'd contact the nursing home administrator, because they should have received a group, what they call a group quarters form.
Ah, okay. Well, that's very helpful. Thanks
all
right. A lot.
Nancy, thanks for your call. You know, my intrepid producer, Amy Jurevich, just informed me that, yes, I did mishear. It is Ohio's three largest cities that are behind, not the state of Ohio. 32% of Cleveland households and 39% in Columbus and Cincinnati have responded, and that's below, below. Is that typical for big cities?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's below the national average. I mean, Columbus, I would expect, because of the, the university population is going to be, it's going to be difficult to count. Because you've got, lots and lots of young people and students who have, complicated residential situations. We're pretty early in the game right now in terms of the response rate. So I would it would be useful at this point for the city officials and local officials to get out there and start, clamoring to remind people to do this and tell them to call up and get another form if they lost it. But I'm not surprised.
You know, I remember a couple years ago when I worked at the Columbus Dispatch. There was a talk about, wow, there are a lot of single men in Pickaway County. Well, there's a prison in Pickaway County.
Right.
And what is the process for counting inmates? And in,
Same thing, quarters.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the same. It's a group. Any institution, residential institution, would be counted by the institution.
Okay, we have an email from Kelly. If you'd like to send us an email, go to allsides@wosu.org. Kelly writes, if a person relocates to a different state shortly after mailing in the census form, that person is congressionally misrepresented for the next 10 years. Has the issue been addressed regarding the practicality and accuracy of doing a once-per-decade count?
This is where you blame it on the founding fathers,
okay.
the framers of the Constitution. In other words, as far as the one person moving away, people move all the time, right? In the United States, as I said before, one in five moves every year. So, and that's one of the reasons that the founding fathers thought that they needed a census in the first place. They discussed, how to do this, and the expense and the logistical issues of counting the population is really are what puts it on a 10-year cycle. In other words, we probably can't do it more frequently than this without, in some sense, spending too much money, disrupting the political structure, if you will. So that's the answer.
An issue out there, Margot, is, mm-hmm. of course, that folks are afraid the data could be used against them.
Mm-hmm.
There's precedent for this?
Well, for the first 115-20 years, mm-hmm. of the census, there were no, Congress hadn't thought about it. And, so there were no standards one way or the other. And in fact, for much of the 19th century, the way the census office, as it was then called, proved the accuracy of the returns was that the enumerators and the local supervisors had to post the census results in a public place so that everybody could take a look at them.
Hmm.
Right? So that was true, and in the 19th century, people asked there were some very sensitive questions on the census, including, questions about people's personal wealth and their real estate holdings and so forth. By the 1880s, there was a mostly because the census also started collecting a lot of economic data about businesses. And businesses began to complain and said, look, we don't want our competitors to know about this stuff. We'll tell you, the government, because we think we need statistical work, but we don't want this made public. In the first decade of the 20th century, Congress then began to tighten up the law. And between basically 1900 and 1929, created the what are now called the confidentiality standards that that exist today, that have been were modified again in the 1960s, but they were put in place in 29. They did this also so that the census form, they also debated whether the census forms would ever become public. And now, of course, genealogists all know that in 72 years after the census is taken, the whole thing is thrown open to the public use at the National Archives. Right? So you can wait 72 years and get things. Okay. Now, within that, there have been various points in the history of the country, going back actually to the Civil War, when government officials have asked for individual-level census data for some other public purpose, and there's been a wide variety of them. The generals in the Union Army used an 1860 census to identify areas of where they could live off the land as they they marched through the South and so forth. They took General William Tecumseh Sherman, for his infamous March to the Sea, used the census results. During World War One, the census results were used to identify people who might be draft dodgers.
Okay.
In other words, because they would look at the 1910 census and see what people thought they were, their age was, and see if they were claiming to be too old or too young. So we have had incidents like that. Every time that's happened, there has been a rethinking of it and an effort to tighten it up. Right, the last big effort was in World War II when Congress repealed during the war the confidentiality pledge and then put it back in after the war.
What? Let's take a phone call right now. 614-292-8513. And Cyrus, you're on the air with Margot Anderson.
Yes, I can. can remember back a few censuses ago when there was something called the long form.
That's right.
A certain percentage of the population got. Is there anything like that now?
The long form is long gone. It is the 2000 census was the last of the long form. The Census Bureau in the 2000s has moved to a new continuous rolling sample survey called the American Community Survey, which asks most of the same questions that were on the old long form, but sort of rolls around the country all the time, every month it's in the field. And those data, when sort of aggregated up over the decade, provide the same level of information, hopefully, that the long form does.
I was going to ask you, are you satisfied with that?
Well, we won't know until after 2010 because we've, you know, this has been a new experimental program this decade. Most demographers and census users in the local government are quite happy about it. Because the complaint about the long form, in addition to it being onerous to fill out, was that the data got very old. In other words, at the end of the decade, the data were no longer very useful for local governments, particularly, who were great users of it. So this way, there's ongoing, timely data. Now, when we get the 2010 census results from the short form, we'll be able to see how well, in some ways, we've done, if you will. And it's just in the same way that an election, you know, in some sense is the proof of the pudding over whether the public opinion polls have the predictions of who's going to win, right, the 2010 census hopefully will do the same thing for the ACS.
The point being, when you say that it changes over time so much, it's the more detail you get from a census, the more it's likely to change, more detailed you begin.
Right, yeah. No, in other words, I mean, if hypothetically right now, we would be looking at 2000 data on house prices, for example, and local governments would only have that to use for estimates of need. I mean, that data is clearly not very useful anymore. We all know that.
Yeah, clearly. Hey, what a great couple years to point out the upside.
Exactly. No, I mean, that's why there's much anticipation to see how the short form results, it's all short form now, look. And then how, because there's enough information on the short form with age and sex and owner-renter status and race and ethnicity for them to do a pretty good sense of a pretty good, analysis of how well the ACS has been doing.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. Cyrus, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
All righty, thank you. Going to take a break, but you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for Professor Margo Anderson. She's an historian, and one of her specialties is the census. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Creator of the HBO series The Wire, David Simon, teamed up with writer Eric Overmyer to create a new HBO series called Tremé. It's set in New Orleans 3 months after Katrina. The show premieres a week from this Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Simon and Overmyer. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Hear more from WOSU anytime at our website, WOSU.org. You can listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archive shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides.
Support for WOSU comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses for 155 years. 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
57 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40. Sunshine today, a high near 70 degrees. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48 degrees. More sunshine for Thursday, a high of 75. And even more sunshine expected for Friday, with highs approaching 80 degrees for Friday. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the U.S. Census. It's underway right now, and my guest is Margo Anderson. She's a professor, history and urban studies at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and census is one of her specialties. So, Margo, we have an email from John. He writes, I live in an apartment. I have gotten nothing to fill out in return. I would like to participate. Why did I not get a form, and can I get one? I'm sorry, John, you've been left out. What's going
right
on?
Well, this is a very good question. And so the question, that means that the addressing system, the address rostering process, failed here. He should go to the Census Bureau website, www.census.gov, and click on the 2010 link, which is on the front, and it right on the thing it says, look for your census form now, need help with your form, and there's a questionnaire assistance and a Be Counted site, and I assume you can send an email as well.
We're going to post that on our website, WOSU.org/allsides. You can go to that link. I hope that helps. Email from Carolyn. Why is there so much concern about how many forms were returned in March when the form clearly states as of April 1st? Good question, Carolyn.
Very good, yes. And there have been many people who have asked me that question. The Census Bureau in some ways did jump the gun here, and I think this is my interpretation, not theirs, is that they have a statutorily required reporting deadline in December when they have to report the apportionment counts for all the states. And so between now and then, they have to count everything, make sure things look okay, and deal with the omissions and any duplicates and any other problems that come up. And believe me, problems do come up. I mean, I think it was 1990, a census office in Brooklyn, New York burned, for example, right? And there have, so what do you do then? So what they're trying to do is essentially get a jump on the process and get a few more weeks in, if you will. I mean, the date of reporting is April 1st.
We have an email from Jeff. Your guest is talking about 200 to 300 years ago, but in this day and age with the internet, people can hack into the computers and access the public information. What is your comment on that? Can the census be hacked?
I don't think so. That's a technical question that I've certainly never seen indications that it has been hacked. Any more than any other government agency. So
right.
I really don't think that's the issue.
Okay, I guess it's time to talk about race, because that's a very interesting part of the forum this time around. And let's just kick off with a phone call from Andrew. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Andrew, what is your beef with the census regarding race?
Well, I have issues with the term white, right?
Mm-hmm.
I myself am of vastly mixed European descent, right? My wife has European, has Native American, and there's doesn't really seem to be anywhere to mark mixed race on the census forms that I got. So we're completely at a loss as how to mark that.
You mean mixed race when it comes to being white?
Well, yeah,
because
pale skin. I mean, I'm not white.
I'm blotchy.
Actually, there
color,
is a way
right?
to do this.
Okay.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
The question, I assume you're referring to questions 8 and 9 here. Question 9 says, what is person 1's race or what a person 2 or
yep.
whatever? Okay.
Yep.
And then it says, mark one or more boxes.
One or more?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big difference, isn't it, Margo?
Yeah.
That was an innovation in 2000.
Okay.
Gotcha. Okay, I didn't see the one or more part. So okay, that makes sense then.
And then there's at the bottom of the list, you know, they give you a bunch, big long list. They also say some other race, and that can be part of the one or more too. And you can do a write-in.
Okay, wonderful.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. You know, one of the fears, one of the issues, I guess, is the fear of minority underrepresentation. Uh-huh. Is that because of this method of counting now, of making these distinctions?
I actually think that the concern about minority undercounting had more to do with the historical fact of undercount.
Okay.
In other words,
it's a chronic problem.
Well, it's a problem of counting. In addition to people with non-standard residential statuses, you know, the poor, people in isolated rural areas, or in illegal dwellings in urban areas. Are hard to count, and so they tend to be, you know, and that would, insofar as that correlates with minority status, you get an undercount.
Now, you know, I wanted to get back to the fellow who wrote about living in an apartment and had not received mm-hmm. his census form. Let's say, you know, you have people in an apartment building, it's a secure building, and, you know, people are mm-hmm. not sending in their census forms from that particular building. And how does a counter enumerator get in there and figure that out when it's not open?
They work with the management of the building on the issue, and it's sometimes a very, sort of delicate negotiation process. By the way, that is not a new problem. One of the things I often do is give people, you know, send people to old newspaper clippings from, 50, 100, 150 years ago, and that problem was very much in evidence, certainly in cities like New York, in the 1890s, the 1900s.
You know, back to race. Mm-hmm. Multiracial is no longer a box.
It never was.
Never was. Okay.
Never was. Yeah.
Now you can mark as many classifications mm-hmm. as apply, but really, isn't that a lot a matter of self-perception?
The census now, because of what because it's a self-enumeration. Mm-hmm. Is what people are what they say they are.
It sounds like you could get some pretty interesting stuff out of that.
Yep.
Do you feel like it's going to be? What do you think you're going to get? I mean, how's the count going to work?
I don't know if we know yet. I do know in other countries have also confronted this. There were some hilarious. Campaigns in the last British census for people to identify themselves as Jedi warriors on one of the questions.
I've heard about people doing the same thing here.
So I think that, and again, that those numbers, there will have to be two things will have to happen. One, they will go into the census, bureau, and either they'll send some enumerator out to check on it or give you a call. Or it'll go into the tabulation process, and there will have to be a decision made about how to report it, whether to report it simply as other, for example.
And because of the self-perception issue, how should one identify their child?
Same issue.
Just in terms of how you perceive them, the child mm-hmm. can't fill it out.
Right. That's right. That's why it's not completely self-enumeration. It's really the person one's evaluation of the status of everybody else in the household.
Now, the president obviously is mixed mm-hmm. and mixed racial background, and he won't tell anybody what he's putting in the box or which boxes he's marking.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
That's kind of, I guess, the beauty of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we had a question, but we don't. The U.S. Constitution really only requires that folks be counted, right, Margo? I mean, that's it, right?
The Constitution says that Congress shall conduct the census. You know that the census shall be conducted in such manner as they shall by law direct, meaning
okay.
that Congress will set the rules. In 1790, the Congress decided that just counting was not enough. So the very first census law statute put on the books in the spring of 1790 required the age and sex as well as the constitutional requirements for to count slave, free, and Indians, you know, and to exclude Indians not taxed. So, I mean, this is where you blame it on Congress. They could, right? Congress could at any point rewrite the law and make it a simple head count.
Now, it bothers people that this is the way a lot of money, federal grants and that sort of thing are divvied up, and funding mm-hmm. for different kinds of things are divvied up is by census numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how else would the government do it?
Right. Exactly. I mean, we decide, again, if you look at the congressional debates, when there is money to be distributed, for example, for highway funding which also, by the way, uses other indicators like the road length and, you know, and lots of other things and measures of density and so forth. But when you look at what the actual legislative process, what they do is they turn to the federal statistical system more broadly, because some things, for example, aren't on the census. We don't ask, we don't ask unemployment, for example, about employment and unemployment on the census. We do that with a separate monthly survey, the current population survey. So when Congress gets around to passing any kind of law, they turn to the federal statistical system and say, "What do you have for us?" And what, you know, and then there's a legislative process to decide how to do it.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Somebody wanted to know if they don't have access to the internet, what number can they call? And we're going to get that number for you right away. And I would say we're going to post it on the web, but if you don't have access to the internet, that won't help you. So we'll get that for you.
I can give them the number
okay.
right now.
It's, all right. Margo's full service.
Yep. Right. 1-866-872-6868. For English, and then if you need a different language, there are different numbers.
Okay, but they can start there at least.
Right, and there's another number, 1-800-923-8282.
Okay. You know, the census has huge impacts, going on in over the decades and over the hundreds of years, and one of them is on our ability to trace our ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a big deal is that now, and does having the simpler form only going to affect the search?
It will 72 years from now.
Okay. We don't have to worry about it then.
No. I mean, in other words, the 1940 census is the next one to be made public, which will be opened in 2012. And that one still has a great deal of detail on almost everybody. After that, the sampling process and the move toward what was called the long form will successively reduce the amount of information on everybody. Everybody will still have the name and address and household relationship and so forth, but no longer the incredible details that was on the earlier censuses.
It really does make you wonder between the fact that we never write letters anymore, and
right, genealogists are going to have to rethink their methodologies. That's what's going to happen.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have a number now. We have the call center number for the census. It's 301-763-4636, or that's 301-763-INFO. Or you can call 1-800-923-8282. If you want to call All Sides with Ann Fisher, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Dan. He says, I just spent 5 minutes at the census website and did not find any way to report not receiving a census form. Okay. All mail is delivered to me by post office box. Are post office boxes excluded from the census mailing?
I think so.
Well, still, wouldn't they be sending it to the...
No, because it's not a residential address.
Gotcha.
In other words, the underlying, the address list, is also a great big map, literally a map, And every address is keyed to that map.
Okay.
So, if you know, a post office box probably is not connected.
So does Dan get counted then, or?
Dan needs to get a form.
Okay, he needs to. Okay, yeah. It's not the fault of the census. This is just how it operates. It's
well,
not...
in other words, the question is whether where he's living, why the form didn't get to him.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, 614-292-8513. And Chris, you're on the air with Margot Anderson, a census historian. You want to talk about sealed records and adoptions? It's a good question. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Yes, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, what I wanted to mention is for those of us that are adopted, our actual ethnicity was not clear in many cases. In my case, I did locate my birth mother, but I was listed as white in my birth certificate. The children's home that had my birth records listed my father as Mexican, and so it was not until I actually contacted my birth mother's family that I did confirm my birth father was Mexican, which makes me half Hispanic. So before that, my parents were told I was part Native American Indian and white, and of course that's true because of the Mexican ancestry side, but I think for many adopted people, we don't know how to report ourselves because our birth records are sealed, and Ohio has not changed that law for people born between 1964 and 1996.
Right.
So what do you think about that?
It's an interesting question, and it is it's one that the census itself would have probably very little to say about, in the sense that the records that you're talking about are all maintained at the state level. In other words, our vital record system in the United States is not a federal system; it's a state system.
Right.
So you're exactly right to be concerned that you need to look to the vital registration agencies at the state in order to address this issue.
I know there are many people that are adopted that are mixed ancestry, and a lot of times if they're light in color, they'll be passed off as white.
Mm-hmm.
If they're dark enough, they might classify as African-American or
mm-hmm.
Native American. So, it turns out I did have Native American, but when I inquired about that before I knew my birth father was Hispanic, they told me you had to know what tribe you were from in order to qualify for any college aid or anything like that. And there's a test called an autosomal DNA test that gives percentages, and I did come out to be about a quarter, but it wasn't until I found out from the children's home through non-identifying information that my father's from Mexico that kind of ruled out the Native American ancestry coming from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a lot of problem for adopted people. Those that could qualify for minority aid or colleges or whatever elsewhere, they can't unless they have the information.
That's right.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, you're
Thanks
welcome.
For listening. We're Bye. Running out of time. I just want to read one email from a listener. It brings up an interesting question. As the census helps illustrate who we are as a collective nation, why not simply add a box in the gender category for transgendered citizens? And that brings up that whole issue of gay marriage and the whole kit and caboodle, Margo, that we didn't even get into.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Maybe next time.
Well, there is a this will be the first census where same-sex marriage is legal in parts of the country.
So you can say so.
And, well, people always have been saying so.
Okay.
Right? People have been identifying probably as married and of the same sex.
Margo, you know, we're running out of time. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No problem.
But thank you for being on the show, Margo Anderson.
Okay.
All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.